So I've been reading these stories lately online about different people who've wanted to form bands. I think I sent you a couple.
Everyone wants to form bands.
So apparently David Bowie...
He had a band.
Was at home in New York City, and a knock comes to the door, and it's John Lennon...
Oh, I know the story.
...and Paul McCartney.
Oh, no. Maybe.
No, and it's John Lennon and Paul McCartney.
But John already knew...
And Bowie. Knocks on the door. He knocks on the door. He says, "We need to start a band." And Bowie says, "What are you talking about? I've already played with John. Paul, I know you, but no. We need to start a band." And David said, "But you hate each other. You promised me, because I suggested this to you a while ago. And you said you'd never play with Paul ever again." And John said, "No, don't worry. We just smoked a bunch of pot. We figured out what the differences were."
Yep.
"And they weren't of our own making. So we're going to form a band."
They were of their own making. It was all Paul's fault.
And so, well, that's an opinion that's only shared by half of the millions of people that know that. The other half doesn't. But the funny thing is that so then they went on to spend the night smoking pot and writing songs. The next day, Bowie calls up John and said, "That was great." He said, "What are you talking about?" He says, "But it was an incredible night." He says, "I don't remember anything." So he calls Paul. Paul says,
"What?
What are you talking about?" And so that was the story of the ill-fated David Bowie, John Lennon, Paul McCartney band.
That never happened.
That never happened.
Yeah, well, because they couldn't remember that it happened.
So, well, apparently there's a bunch of songs somewhere, written somewhere, and some tape-recorded cassettes.
So there's a catalog somewhere.
Maybe.
Well, depending upon who you want to believe in life of this supergroup.
Yep.
So you have another supergroup story for you?
I have a story, though. Are we ready to talk?
We've been talking.
Okay. What do you think I've been doing? I've been sitting here.
Well, I don't know whether you were.
He came in singing White Rabbit.
Yeah.
And it was more an Elmer Fudd White Rabbit,
right.
I might add.
So I have a story about a song that almost never was.
Okay, so this is...
It's an interesting story.
Isn't that the song that never was? Wasn't that a song?
A movie or something.
It's a movie.
No.
Something
like that.
Anyway,
it's a line in a song. Go ahead.
Let me tell you about a song that Keith Richards wrote for Black and Blue.
Ooh.
And
one of my favorite.
It was a reggae song.
Okay, so this is during that Island Records when they went over collection.
Right. So he wrote a song, and it was called Never Stop. And they made 50 recordings of it. 50. And they didn't like any of them.
So this is when Chris Blackwell was their producer.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But Keith called them abysmal and requested every one of the tapes to be erased. But because he's Keith, no one listened to him, and they just archived them all. Right.
So are they coming out?
Hold on. This is a good story.
With the Bowie tapes.
Oh.
So what happens 5 years later, 6 years later, whatever, between Black and Blue and Tattoo You. So Tattoo You, they created 6 songs in the studio, and then Mick and Keith stopped talking to each other.
As happens. It was similar to John and Paul.
So they didn't have an album's worth. And so without an album's worth, their producer's like, "Well, let's look in the archives." So they pulled up all these songs from the archives, and they stumble across Never Stop, except it's a reggae song. They did one cut of it as a rock song. And Mick called it a gift, and Keith called it barbaric. But they put it together and released it. They changed the title of it from Never Stop to Start Me Up.
Ah.
And so, which became their first
single their first single.
And this is the sort of, there's two parts of this. First part is many years later, Microsoft. Thank you. One of those companies.
Microsoft.
Yeah, Microsoft. What they wanted to do for the startup of the DOS thing.
Right. Paid them $14 million for the rights to use Start Me Up.
So Keith then changed his mind and said it was an okay song. Because he got $14 million.
$14 million. It's like their number one, you know, sort
it
of.
It was
like,
a
you know,
hit single for a long
hit
time.
So
it charted top 10.
So in the, they called it the top hits chart back then. It's now mainstream rock chart by Billboard. It was number one on the for 13 weeks solid, and that was a record that was not broken until 1994, and three bands broke the record that year: Mariah Carey, which is okay, and then NSYNC or
NSYNC.
The Backstreet Boys. But the one that hit 15 weeks was Stone Temple Pilots. And it was their, I have to remember.
Is it Plush?
No, it was the,
Interstate
Love Song.
Oh.
Went 15 weeks. Now, the record on mainstream is now Three Doors Down. Loser in 2001 did 21 weeks at the top. But it's like, this is a song that almost never got made. If they had erased the tapes, they would never have it. But it ends up being their number one money maker as a single, just because of the Microsoft deal, of course. But it was also a huge hit at the time.
It was a great song.
And
I wonder what the reggae version sounds like.
I'd love to hear that. I'm sure they have 50 takes of it.
49.
You know when they archive the, you know, when they let out those extra releases,
right,
and extra long dirty tracks.
It's in the box set.
Yes.
So the interesting part, the last interesting part about the song is that when they released it, Keith did not like the song. Still.
You know, like I said, until he got the $14 million, probably.
And so, but it is their sixth most played song in concert. I mean, for the Stones. So that it's in their rotation all the time. And Keith routinely misplays the first five chords. And they're you know,
intentionally.
That is the opinion, is that he intentionally misplays the first five chords.
Because he doesn't want to start it up.
Yeah. He wants to play the reggae version.
Right,
and
exactly.
I think that's hysterical. It's an interesting story, and it's, you know, got a lot of little pieces, but it's, you know, almost didn't happen.
And that's one of their songs, the first bar.
It's Keith playing it too.
Yeah.
That's the funny thing. It's sort of like, you know, the great stories about, I want to say it was, I forget what song it was based upon, but they asked Keith how he got his unique sound on guitar in certain songs. And he said, you know, I was pretty effed up one night and I was recording myself.
Night.
And I was recording myself playing, you know, something on, and I was recording on a cassette. And I found that I was overdriving the cassette. So, you know, if you remember how cassette tapes, you know, would have the little needle on it,
right,
to show that it was overdriven. And then he'd play it back and then play it against itself. So he'd almost like create a layer, have another cassette deck, but it'd be overdriven, and he'd like the overdriven sound more than he liked the pure guitar. So he was get into the habits of going into the studio, recorded the same opening bars of a song, overdriving it, recording it three or four or five layers, and that became the Keith. Just like you've always talked about the Ringo drum move.
Yep.
Right.
This was the Keith Richards
signature sound.
Right, yep. Ability to create a sound for his guitar without using a different trickery of a wah-wah pedal or effect, And he'd always come in with the same damn three old cassette decks. And it was hilarious because here they have these multi-million dollars worth of equipment and here's these three pieces of crap. Realistic.
realistic when
Radio Shack.
Maxwell, here we go.
Right. Well, it wasn't from Maxwell. It was Radio Shack. And it was Radio Shack tapes. Okay. It was Tandy. Yeah. You know, and it's hilarious because, I mean, they were good quality devices and stuff like that, but they were not the multi-million dollar recording studio devices. But it became such a signature move for him that he wouldn't abandon it.
Yeah.
You know,
we had a number of those when I was, you know, the house engineer, that the guys would come in and they'd say, well, it has to be turned up to 11 and I have to put a carpet in front of it because that's the sound I want.
Right.
You know, so they had all these different tricks that they would use to get that sound. You know, and that was, you know, wanting to be their signature sound or whatever.
I don't want to say that it's the disguise of an untalented player, because Keith is certainly not an untalented player, and there are others who do that. But it used to be that the poor musician would use that trickery. And I don't know when it became that, whether it became like something that, like Keith did or others, where they would make that move. But there was that time period, I want to say, from the middle 60s to about 82, you know, right when you were working in the club, because I remember that period of time when I was working, doing a lot of television stuff, and, you know, in the studio, where that would be the thing that they would want. Like, run that microphone down two blocks, put a crappy radio so that it's there coming out of the radio speaker, so it looks like, sounds like a car radio. That was the other thing
it's
we used to do.
It's traveling down the hall, you know.
Is that we used to do it where we'd go into car speakers.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you'd run it through car speakers, and they take the output of the car speakers through the microphone and feed it back into the recording session.
So one more thing. I'll start with you. To your point, they recorded the vocals in a bathroom.
Yeah, you know.
Because, you know, they got the sound they wanted, and it was a special bathroom in one place. It wasn't in the studio. They had to go someplace else because that was the bathroom they could record in, which I thought was, you know, really.
There's great stories. What was the one with Deep Purple and they in the hotel? They were in a hallway in a hotel.
Oh, probably had an echo.
When they recorded Smoke on the Water, and, you know.
The dum, dum, dum.
But it was
dum.
Just, you know, it had that sound, you know. Or, right. You know, they rent the farmhouse out in Lancashire.
You know, and that's certainly, you know, the Wall of Sound guy. I can't believe I'm blocking his
Phil
name.
Spector.
Phil Spector. Yeah. Thank you. That Phil...
The Wall of
was,
Sound. Yeah.
Was that guy.
That master of
that,
figuring
who took
out.
It from Les Paul... of taking something and overdriving it and so that it became this wall coming at you and overpowering you.
It was the layers of sound.
The layers, well, or the wall
and,
of sound.
You know, and kind of to answer your question, I mean, how many times have you been around a musician that played something saying, how'd you do that? And then they take it and then they add something onto that. And the next guy says, how'd you do that?
Well, I think the 62 to 82 or whatever you said.
65 or so.
Well, that's the era that... modern electronics.
I was just
going to
say,
again, having worked in the studio at that time, nobody was really doing multi-track.
Right.
64, 65 was really the start. Because you were still splicing tape. Mm-hmm. You weren't editing tape. You're still splicing tape. You had maybe a 16 input, maybe a 24 input board. It wasn't more than that. And then you'd have to record something, and then you bounce the track to another tape machine and stuff like that. So you were bouncing tracks and stuff like that. It didn't have the ability like they have now, where they have 108 inputs,
right.
And they're doing each microphone from the drum kit. They have 22 mics on the drum kit, 17 mics on the piano, because they want to capture the pounding of the pedal sound or the little ting of the bell on the thing.
There's a great story with the Beatles that when the 8-track recording came out, and they didn't they were not allowed to have an 8-track. So they actually, the Beatles broke into EMI recording studio in London and stole an 8-track from EMI so they could use an 8-track, which I thought was, you know, what are you going to do, arrest the Beatles? Right. Go ahead, do it.
So I was telling Walden today, Lenny, I got my boys bought the family. I'm sorry, I bought the family Spotify. Which
I was about to say, let's get real.
Which I didn't know I had for like about a year and a half. And so finally I asked one of the boys, it's like, can you sign me up here? And he's like, sure, Dad. So he put it on the phone. So in the Super Camry, I have one of those little FM converters so I can listen to it, my Bluetooth over. I've been listening to the Beatles lately.
There you go.
And you talk about the technology, and like Walden said, you can tell when they stop touring. You can tell when they stop doing this. You can tell when they start doing this because you listen to those albums all the way through.
All the different. So, okay. So look at that era that you just described.
And it's what, 63
You look at it. It was 65. So you think about it. So just put this mark. Oh, I hit the mic. Put this mark right here. Revolver. Pet Sounds. Mm-hmm. Magic Mystery, Magic Mystery Tour, not Magic Mystery Tour.
Sergeant Peppers.
Not Sergeant Peppers, but what's the one I'm thinking?
Rubber Soul.
Rubber Soul.
The Satanic Majestic Request.
They're all right in that.
They're all right in that chunk of the 3 years, and there's some great stories I've been reading lately about different people visiting Brian Wilson. So here's, you talk about the hub. So visiting Brian Wilson, say, here, listen to this, mofo. Here. Oh, you got that? Here, listen to this.
I got this from Keith's cassette deck.
listen to what this guy did. And it was this, without being rear ends to each other, what can you do next against this? And so, Brian Wilson went in and did... he tried to do Smile, which didn't come out till years later, but Good Vibrations, that whole
that era. Was a groundbreaking song,
right? Sure. And so you look at that and you go, okay, those weren't individual accomplishments; those weren't things that someone necessarily. I mean, they were great musicians and they could do great things by themselves, but. I influence you, and that circle went around in that period of time. The record labels, as much as they were rear ends, didn't stop them from them necessarily doing that.
Collaborating they couldn't, and creating.
They couldn't record on the same album or name themselves, so you have Eric Clapton playing on Beatles albums. You have George Harrison playing on other things. You have Delaney and Bonnie and Friends, where no one could name who's really the band, which is, Duane Allman, George Harrison, Eric Clapton, all these guys. And you say, who the hell is Delaney and Bonnie? Was really Clapton, and all the, fast forward to the Wilburys, where they could, or they controlled their own destiny and can do that. But that period of time had two significant things, I think. Number one, the technology that you mentioned, the ability to utilize and be able to, try things technology-wise, and the willingness to collaborate and the lack of jealousy that might have emerged at another era because they were all, having that moment.
Well,
and Pod had a lot to do with it. I'm sorry.
So we've talked about Laurel Canyon before.
Oh, yeah.
But Laurel Canyon was a great place where people would just show up at parties. And I remember there's a great story about Joni Mitchell showing, George Harrison open tuning. And he had never seen it before. And it was one of these,
what is that?
You can do that? And she's playing chords on open tuning, which is a completely different chord structure, right, type of thing, fingering. But he was totally blown away by it because never seen it before. And she'd been playing open tuning for, you know, most of her adult life.
So what song did he record?
I have no idea.
That'd be a great one to find out.
It's one of those things where in those days, they'd sit around and play music with each other and, you know, who cares, right? You know, it's just what it is.
So, you know, you there's so many stories and things come to my mind, but I was on a plane the other day and I watched Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Ah, yes.
And so there's that Brad Pitt,
right,
and Leonardo DiCaprio, you know, faux story by Quentin Tarantino about the night where Sharon Tate got killed. But it's the just the virgin, you know, timeline, you know, where, you know, Charlie wanted to be a member of some band, or
the Beach Boys.
Jim Morrison told him no, turned him down to play in the band, and so he got, so I forget what happens, but they go in the canyon and the whole thing, and then they wind up killing Charlie Manson's people. It's just. Ay. Anyway, I'm sorry I diverted off of that, but you triggered that Laurel Canyon moment. Who told that man to drive a car up here? Must be some damn hippies. Meantime, he's saying that as he's smoking a blunt that's the size of a 747. And it's the dichotomy of calling him a damn hippie while he's got this huge blunt in his mouth.
You know, hippies are different.
And he's, by the way, as they're playing Steppenwolf in the background.
Yeah, well.
So just put that together.
Well, they're nice. They're in Topanga Canyon as opposed to Laurel, but you know.
So someone said something to me the other day that I found fascinating, and this was someone that didn't grow up in the era that we grew up in, right? You know, which is
1820s.
Exactly.
It was and before the tube, before the vacuum tube.
Call Steppenwolf one of the most original punk bands that ever lived. And I said, of all the times that I've listened to Steppenwolf, seen Steppenwolf, thought about Steppenwolf,
punk never entered
my mind. He says, well, obviously you don't know music.
And that explains everything, doesn't it, Walden?
And after I was like, you know,
that part.
So you know the thing where your mouth sort of flaps open, and almost a Ralph, you know, Glia Hamana Hamana. You know, it was like I'm looking at him. He says, "Yeah, they were really good." I said, "Son, did you ever hear of the Clash? Did you ever hear of the Ramones? Iggy Pop." Says, they were copycats. And I wish there was video of this, because you'd see my face in a daze. And so I looked at him, and I said, they were copycats. Iggy Pop was a copycat. The Ramones were a copycat. The Clash was a copycat.
The Sex Pistols were a copycat.
Yeah, right, you know, so as I'm going through my brain, I'm trying to figure out, like, what were they copying?
Right.
Like, what was... And I got to tell you, I drew a blank. So I didn't know what to tell for the guy. So I just walked away.
You were speechless?
I just walked away.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. I wish I had a camera of that.
Exactly.
That's
where I'm going.
What do you say after that?
You know, just...
So I can see...
Something about you can't fix stupid or...
You know, the Steppenwolf being a...
Inspiration.
Inspiration for, you know, Chicago, which is interesting.
That's an interesting one. I would never pull...
Freeform guitar, you know, there's like...
Yeah, okay. The original producer, not the slick Chicago... CTA.
Yeah.
So CTA, not the slick but, love song.
You know, but
I stopped after five.
The entirety of the Steppenwolf's really early career was just jamming on stage. Fine. They only had three songs or four songs, 10 songs,
okay,
whatever.
So I'll give you an original punk band right now. It came to my mind. MC5. Do you remember MC5?
Yeah.
MC5 out of Detroit.
Yep.
MC5. you know, and the craziest.
Kick out the Jams. Fred Sonic Smith.
Ted Nugent.
I
don't know if
I'd Motor City Madman.
I don't know.
Some of his songs were kind of punkish. Early stages, he was playing without really
the Amboy
structure.
Dukes.
Yeah,
Amboy Dukes.
After Amboy Dukes.
After Amboy Dukes, he was playing without structure.
Yeah.
For a while there, and then he became, much more refined. But the Nuge in that period between after Amboy Dukes and just before he found his niche in playing was, but guess what? That was right around in the early 70s when what started? Punk rock as we know it.
Yeah, well, there was there's that sort of the guitar coming from being a rhythm guitar, guitar thing, to being the lead. There's that time frame where you get Chicago doing, their total freeform crazy guitar work.
25 or 64. Think of the guitar.
Well, there was freeform guitar on the album with the name of the song.
Yeah. And you had Steppenwolf doing it. You had a number of bands that would let their guitarists go and just let them play. And that, I'll give maybe Cream a lot of credit for putting that guitar up front. Hendrix is a little bit later.
Yeah, but even Hendrix, I was reading the story about it, that they were, and this is in London, Jeff Beck, Jimi Hendrix, Jimmy Page, Eric Clapton, Buddy Guy. Five legends, guitar heroes of the nth degree. And they wanted to jam. So they were at the famous Ronnie Lane's. Ronnie Lane's. So Ronnie's got Jeff Beck booked in, and Jeff Beck walks in with these guys.
I brought some friends.
And you talk about free-form guitar. Supposedly, everybody walked out, drenched in sweat from the insanity of it.
And nobody recorded it.
No, I don't think so.
But it's amazing, out of those five guys you just mentioned, the styles are so different.
Exactly, but that's what I'm saying. So they all decided to play Stratocasters.
So the sounds are the same.
So that's what I found interesting. So they all decided to play Stratocasters, and apparently, each one took a turn, and then Buddy Guy took over and just wasted them. And where I saw the story was a story just written about Buddy Guy with Kingfish, the new 23-year-old.
Right.
If you haven't heard him yet, incredible guitar player. I don't know that I've heard a more talented, current, young guitar player. I'm talking about blues guitar player. This guy is pretty incredible. But apparently, Buddy Guy shredded him on the Stratocaster. I know what it was. It was called the Stratocaster Sessions. It was done by Fender just recently.
So the story.
And supposedly there's a video of it right now. So for those who haven't seen it, it's called the Stratocaster. It's called the Fender Sessions or the Stratocaster Sessions, and it's supposedly, I know you're going to want to see it now. It is supposedly like rip me up kind of thing, and this is Buddy Guy on his retirement tour now.
Well, Buddy Guy, I saw him on the retirement tour, and it was pretty amazing. I had many opportunities to meet him in the 80s, and he was totally amazing, and... But he had a lot to say about Jimi Hendrix, Jimi Hendrix stole all my moves.
That's exactly.
And he did it left-handed.
That was what was part of that story. Is that Buddy Guy said, without me cursing on this, said, okay, mofo, take this.
Right.
And it was like, and everyone was like, oh shit, that old guy just tore us up.
Well,
it left us on the curb.
It left us on the curb. Kind of moment. So speaking about...
Well, I was going to ask you, did you have a topic today?
so actually,
I mean, we're 30 minutes in.
So
you know?
I actually, so here's, so I had the pleasure, and I do mean pleasure, this past Saturday to go see what was supposed to be, and might actually be, and for, until further notice, you know, until they actually sign their next contract, when hell freezes over a second time, to see the Eagles. So I saw the Eagles this past Saturday night. You know, my daughter and my grandson happily joined me for the concert at in Charlotte at Spectrum Center, of all places. And I got to tell you, first of all, the opening act was sick.
Who were they?
Steely Dan.
Mm.
So it, apparently...
Which Steely Dan is it?
It was the wife of...
Fagan.
Apparently deathbed kind of sick. So on Thursday when they found out that they're going to have to cancel, they said, oh, crap, we're not going to be able to get anybody.
Right.
So they all looked around the room and they looked around, Vince Gill sitting there, and they're talking about it. He says, you're popular in Charlotte, aren't you? He says, yeah, I'm a little bit popular here, boys. He says, how do you feel? He says, yeah, I think I could do a session. He played, he opened, did an hour and a half that tore down the house. So imagine Vince Gill by himself with his studio musician that he normally performs with, who I don't remember, Travis Jacks, somebody like that. Travis,
just two guys.
So they did an hour and a half, and it was incredible. I mean, there were 17,000 people packed to the highest rafters in the Spectrum Center, and he held them captivated. So it was sort of like when we saw Rodrigo and Gabriela in Red Rocks.
Yeah.
He held them
those
in his palm
amazing.
Of his hand,
yeah.
And he just played his heart out, and they must have got five, six, seven standing O's.
But you know, you get the two guys out there, and what, they just had two acoustics?
Two acoustics. It was incredible. So wait.
But there's no substitute for good talent.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So it was pretty incredible. And his voice, I've been reading some of the reviews and anticipating this concert. He's good. But he doesn't have the voice that, you know, he does. How does he really sound? Well, after the multiple ovations, and he said, thank you. Now my other friends are going to come up and play, and I'm going to join them. Well, the Eagles walk out. They do 2 hours that Vince Gill is a part of also. And there was not one song that you didn't, that everybody, I mean,
songs
everybody knew, sang, was a part of, number one. Number two, that not just Vince Gill, but, you know, everybody just took part in and was amazing.
So,
but the killer was Joe Walsh.
Yeah. So I saw
Joe Walsh. Let me finish this and you go talk about your thing. Joe Walsh got by himself seven. Now, up until that moment of the concert, so we're an hour into the concert. And then they let Joe take over and play
Joe songs.
Play, or lead guitar, and like he tends to do. He got 7 different standing ovations. Now, after the third standing ovations, when the other guys, like Timmy Schmidt, did a song, got a standing O. Deacon Fry. The son of the one who died.
Yeah. Son of Glenn Frey. Yeah.
Boy, pitch perfect, sounds like his dad, almost spooky.
Really?
Sounds like his dad. You know, just hit every note, you know? When, what's his name, came out from the drums,
Henley.
Don Henley, mm-hmm. Same, you know, was on fire. They finished the concert at about an hour 45, said thank you, and you think they're going to end. They walk off, you know, and the audience is just like...
Going nuts.
Well, no, the audience was stunned. Because, remember, they just saw an hour and a half and an hour and 45 minutes of top-notch entertainment. So people did the turn on the cell light, right? 5 minutes later, they walk out and said, turn off that. Crap. You knew we were going to come out anyway. And they do another 20, 25 minutes.
Yeah.
It's yep. like, where do you... There are bands that should no longer go on the road anymore. There are bands that were great when they were when they were in their moment. I mean, we saw the Stones 2 years ago. We both talked about that. Walden, you know, and I went. I was very disappointed and other things like that. And there are bands who just still spot on they have it. These guys... I think they just signed a 100-night contract for the Sphere, and they're going to Europe for.
Did you get your tickets yet?
I'm probably going to go. It was. Now here's the odd thing, and I'll stop. Here's the odd thing. I saw them 52 years ago. Mm-hmm. They might be better now.
We did a benefit in Aspen. When they did, right before Hell Freezes Over, got together. Glenn Frey had his band there.
Right.
But Henley was there, Walsh was there, in a small club at the Double Diamond in Aspen. And they were amazing. In the small club, even, where you can pick out those little things. You know, you can get away with some things in a big arena, but when you get in a small club...
I got to tell you, the sound was... Yeah. So I've been to two major concerts in big arenas of late. There is something going on where they're finally waking up to spending the money
and getting sound,
to getting quality sound. That sound was crystal clear, mixed perfectly. And you know what? I could be a stickler when it comes to that. Mixed perfectly. You could. So there was a couple of piano breaks where they have one of the recognized in there. You heard every note, even between the guitars.
I'm talking about the hammers hitting. And
oh, my. It was just.
That's your 17 microphones.
Well, I'm sorry. It is.
So
I know you wanted to talk about
it. I just wanted to say I saw them on a tour 2-3 years ago, and Joe Walsh was the standout. And I knew it was going to happen, but, you know, they made room for him to play some of his hits, you know, Rocky Mountain Way. Life's been good to me so far. Life has been good to him so far.
Yeah. Some Funk 49, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So 49. Here's the sad thing. The only sad thing about the concert is that Joe can no longer really enunciate a word.
Oh.
So he still is amazing guitarist, but they had to put up the words projected on the back of him so that the people could understand what we say.
Well, you couldn't understand him 30 years ago either. You
know? Yeah, but this is particularly...
Yeah, three years ago, whenever I saw him, he was still...
Did he have a stroke or was it drug damage?
Who knows? Maybe it was just a bad night for him.
You know? It's an interesting thing, and it's a little bit a lateral topic here, is I don't know if you've seen the special on...
People who forget what they're doing.
Well, it's Parkinson's. Glenn Campbell.
Oh my God! Yeah,
and it was amazing. And they're saying he doesn't know, you know, or didn't know at the time, you know, night from day, but he could get out and play
Tony Bennett
because it was so ingrained in his mind that he could still play it.
Did you take him
out of that scene, and he was.
You
lost.
Saw the Lady Gaga, Tony Bennett, Radio mm-hmm. City Music Hall.
Oh gosh,
special yeah. where. I mean, like you said, he doesn't even know yeah. his name. But you star him on a song, and he was
clicks right
still,
in.
Not just clicks in, not just remembering the words, but still was pitch perfect.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, God blessed him with an amazing gift.
Well,
right
and,
there.
And it's such in what they were saying with the, you know, with Glenn Campbell is how he can do that. It's been so ingrained in him. He's played it so many times. He feels it. He knows it. He understands it. But you take him off of that, and it was a fantastic. I mean, it was a very sad special, but it was a fantastic special that really kind of pulls. He's part of the Wrecking Crew. You know, I mean, that's where he started back in that day, and that was good stuff. But I'm glad you got to see that concert. That'd be fun.
That was a fun concert. You know, I've been debating what other bands I'm willing to see, because you get so disappointed. You know, it's sort of like, you know, what's the statement? Never meet your heroes.
Right.
Never go to see a
print
band
the legend.
That was so good back when, because when I saw the Rolling Stones recently, someone said, oh, the Stones are touring again. I said, not me. Can't do it.
You know, Fleetwood Mac, when we saw them, what, 4 or 5 years ago here, they were phenomenal.
Stevie Nicks. When I saw Stevie Nicks last year, and even though I never loved them that much in concert,
they put on a good show.
Billy Joel tore up the house. And I would recommend to anybody, I mean, he's doing a TV special, right. So you can see it sitting in the, you know, you've all got your 86-inch TVs with big stereo surround sound.
Shake like, the dust out of the room.
You know, so, I mean, he knows how to put on a show.
Yep.
It only took him, you know, 50 years to figure out how to do it.
Well, he went into retirement for how long?
For a while, but did I ever tell the original Billy Joel story that of this, which I don't think I ever told you. So, New York Academy of Music had to be 72? 71?
Maybe earlier because
earlier.
Piano Man came out, I mean, you know.
It might have been earlier.
Early 70s. So
he was opening for somebody. He was the opening act. And at the time, he was only doing covers. He got booed off the stage after 3 songs. You know, you almost felt bad for the kid. And he was a kid then. But it was like, who the hell is this and what is he doing? Bring on the main act. I don't even remember the main act. That's too many years ago gone by. But he was just, and I think that scarred me for a while with Billy Joel.
Oh, yeah, you have mentioned that. And so I have a story just the opposite. I was talking to a friend of mine right before he came in here, and we were talking about concerts where the opening act disappoints or the opening act is so great, and he had the chance to see Dick Dale play in a small club, and he says, I don't even know who the main act is. I went to go see this main act and
don't even remember it.
Got out there.
Dick Dale came out and just blew
on,
the place
come
apart.
On, it's Dick Dale, come on,
the king of surf.
Like, yeah. Oh, wait a second, I'm you know this opening guy Michael Jackson is playing. I don't know who he is really, but I'm going to go see him.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Well,
so there's a blind Puerto Rican guitarist, not Jose Feliciano. Raul Midan is his name. And this has to be 2005. So he had not yet been signed a record label. He was touring with Al Jarreau and George Benson.
That's a group.
And he was the opening act. And I saw this guy. He did an hour. I walked out. I was done.
He didn't even want to see Benson.
I was walked out. I was done. He was so good. I then saw that he got picked up by maybe Quincy Jones' label, and Herbie Hancock signed on to be his producer. And that was one of the best, you know, first albums. You know, he could make his voice sound like a saxophone.
What was his name again?
Raul Midan.
Okay, there you go.
And he's just, so Raul Midon. And he's had a couple of albums. After like his third or fourth album, it was like, okay. But those first two or three albums were just like, oh, crap.
Good stuff.
This is good stuff. Best opening act you ever saw?
Best opening act I ever saw, probably Jay Giles Band.
Best opening act I ever saw, Jay Giles Band. True, and true.
Was it the venue or was it the band or both?
Oh, no. So I went to see Peter Frampton on the Frampton Comes Alive tour, and Jay Giles warmed up for him. Well, you know, I was going, you know, right?
You're going through a weird era. No, I'm just kidding.
But, well, I was thinking, I hadn't really heard the, I don't believe I hadn't heard the album, but Peter Frampton from, you know, he was a blues brilliant guitarist, and he didn't do any of that. But Jay
Giles, just felt what he felt, right, or saw what he saw. Do you hear what he sees?
So I went to see. I wanted to see the sort of, again, like you say, don't meet your icons. Well, I went to see Peter Frampton, how I knew him, not what he was, and you know, I was disappointed. But Jay Giles came out,
yes,
and blew apart the whole. I mean, the whole place erupted. And when Peter Frampton came out, he was booed. Bring Irish. Back the crowd had been won over and was screaming for Jay Giles to come out and do one more encore, because opening acts don't get encores.
Right.
They wanted an encore so bad. And
did they come out?
No. Peter was quite insistent on, everybody just quiet down. They were a great. Let's give it up for Jay Giles. But now
it's
my turn. Yeah. And it's like, well, yeah. So half the crowd left. I left, yeah, after about three songs. You know, the other opening act that I saw, that it's not really fair, but Jeff Beck was an opening act.
That's like someone made a mistake.
Well, yeah, ZZ Top was the headliner.
Well,
what did the Beatles call that? A double A side?
Yeah, double A side, right? So you know, that kind of counts as an opening act, but not really. You know, but the surprise was Jay Giles by far. I was just I went out and bought the album the next day. I'd never heard of him before, yeah, and it was like...
So that was, what, 77?
70? 71?
So for me, I'm going to say that I think I saw them for the first time in 69 or 68.
House band.
So they were the... So if you've never read it, the autobiography of Bill Graham is a great book. Let me first start off there. Bill Graham was a Holocaust survivor. I don't know if most people know that. He was a Holocaust survivor. He and his sister got out of a Nazi war camp, the whole deal, came over to the United States, adopted by American family, Jewish, the whole deal, decided that, and his parents liked music, so he listened to music, but he couldn't play. So he decided to be a music impresario. Someone used to dub me that once. They said, "You're an impresario." So he became a concert producer in New York City. And he put on small shows and stuff like that. And he went up to Boston to go find bands that he could have. He was charging at the time $350, $450, and $550 for tickets for the concerts. Remember, it's still the late 60s. $550 was a little steep, right? You know, now, fortunately, I could do it, you know, but not everybody could do it. So I forgot what show I was going to see. I don't remember what show it was. But, he went out, ladies and gentlemen.
Is it Fillmore?
Fillmore East. Yeah. Fillmore East. He says, "Ladies and gentlemen, there's a band I just discovered. They're going to be our house band from now on. Whenever we need somebody to, you know, to start or whatever, and we can't, you know, they're going to be our band." And they came out, and they did an hour. They wouldn't let them leave the stage. They needed another half hour, and it was just... Amazing.
Yeah.
It was amazing. And they had a stage presence, I think, and a stage energy between Magic Dick on harmonica, Jay Giles on guitar, Peter Wolf, you know, with his whole stage act. I mean, mm-hmm. He was a showman. I mean, say what, you know, you like him, don't like him, lots of controversy surrounding him, whatever. But when he was on stage, he was in his element, and he was moving and grooving and shaking away. And he was singing these old blues songs that they played, like "Serve You Right to Suffer," mm-hmm. "First I Look at the Purse," you know, all these before they became the Jay Giles Freeze Frame and other stuff like that. They really were a blues band, mm-hmm. and that's how they started out for the first two or three years, and then they became the house band for Fillmore West, and everybody got pissed off because, and so they had to come back.
Oh, they got pissed off for leaving?
Yeah.
How well were they received in West?
Oh, very well. I mean, by that point, they had already been signed for a record. They already had their first hit record and stuff like that, which is, like you said, 70 or 71, like that. But when I knew them, they had no records. They were just doing blues covers.
Right.
So I want to remember, there was one night where they were on the set with B.B. King, and there was some other blue, and B.B. was obviously the headliner. He brought him back out. He brought him back because he was that kind of musician that he already knew that he was the king.
Right.
He didn't have any ego issue sort of thing bringing the people out. And it was amazing.
That would have been a show to see. Anything with B.B. King would be a show to see. You saw him.
Oh, my God.
How many times?
I don't even know.
I had dinner with him.
Okay. I don't know. But so speaking of which,
did you play your guitar for him?
No.
So you say you had dinner with him. So fast forward. So I of course, met him a couple of times and other stuff like that. So my daughter is working at the B.B. King Blues Club in New York City. Mm-hmm. And she was the house manager there. And she was the house manager there for 2 years, 3 years. And this happened several times. George Clinton walked in, said, "I met your dad." B.B. King, "I've seen your dad." You know, and you know, it's those kind of weird moments in your life, like you said, when you go, "Fuck, did I do something? Pardon me, did I do something wrong? did I actually f up in this situation?"
Uh-huh.
Well, I
used to run a Kansas City blues thing, didn't you?
I was in Des Moines, but this was before. This is what led to it. Is that in I want to say 88 or 87.
He's a youngin'.
He is. He's a puppy.
The company, I worked for a software company, and, you know, at the time, you know, Microsoft's hiring, you know, like Emerson, Lake, and Palmer to play their company parties. We were like, "Oh, we need to get a band together," you know. So we got a list of all these bands and how much they charge. And B.B. King, $15,000.
I'll take it.
It's like, are you kidding me?
I'll take it.
So we rented out a surf ballroom. It had the original, like, it was perfect. Staged, great dance floor, and
you could slide across it.
Oh, you could. Oh, yeah, it was great. The 400 people.
Wow.
And a night with B.B. King. My brother Eric got to be the warm-up band, which so he got to. It's like, I got to be on stage with, not really on stage, but, you know.
Yeah.
You know.
You're on the same bill.
But it was a small place, and so we had dinner ahead of time, and we all ate together. So I got to sit at the table with B.B. King and his band, and it was just sort of a nice, relaxing, and he was the most...
Very gentlemanly guy.
Gentleman. You know, I didn't know what to expect, but at the time, you know, B.B. King was...
B.B. King.
Was B.B. King. But it wasn't before sort of the Eric Clapton, you know,
That's 15 years later.
It reinvented B.B. King again.
Right.
It brought him to the, you know, sort of the forefront, but into the night and all that sort of, you know.
Right.
But the he was, could be had cheaply, and he just played his heart out, and it was just,
playing the chicken circuit.
It was amazing.
You know, it's interesting. You say sitting at dinner, and I can remember, you know, back at the clubs, you sit down after the van's packed and everything. You're sitting at the bar having a beer. Most of them are pretty much just normal people and just doing what they're doing, and they enjoy what they do, and they have a special gift. And, you know, it's really interesting. And that's one of the things that struck me after a while of working in the industry was, like, they're just normal people. Out to have a good time.
Well, a lot of them.
Yeah, they play
are.
One hell of a guitar, but.
A lot of them are, and then a lot of them are ripping up the hotels.
Yeah, that, some of them are just.
that's a different issue.
Yeah, some of them are just on the other side of the market.
That's
there.
A different issue entirely. You know, there are musicians.
I'm going to have to edit like 20 minutes. Wait a second. Let me
think about this for a second. Did you want me to say something?
Well, I got blank spaces.
So I will say there's a
that's an opportunity for Walden to insert himself.
I am going to insert myself right now. So there's this bar, Rock Palace in Kansas City called the Uptown, and it's this big place. It's got a dome on it with stars on the dome. So you look up and it looks like you're outside.
Got stars on the dome.
Yeah, but next door to it is the Uptown Bar. I mean, it's like right next door, and if you go in early or go in, late, you'll often find the bands that were playing just drop by afterwards and have a,
having a burger and a burger and a Blintz.
Well, of course, they're holding court, sort of, because no one's leaving them alone. You were great, but I met so many musicians at the Uptown Bar when I lived in Kansas City. It's in a dive part of town, by the way, but probably still is a dive.
Then that's usually the best places to find those places.
Yeah,
find those bars.
But Patti Smith hung out there. William Burroughs.
See, that's the only reason why you remember.
How did he get it? Did you see how he worked Patti Smith right into that?
But no, all these sort of punk bands, and because I was there in the early '80s, so all these new wave and punk bands come play there.
They were copycats at that time.
Well, they were. They copied everybody.
Copied Steppenwolf.
So,
guys, we're coming up on an hour here.
So what are you saying here?
Well, we can either keep going or we can save a little for the next time around.
I never want to leave too much left in the gas tank. I want to drive until I'm empty. And speaking of running on empty.
Jackson Brown.
So your statement about the rodeo reminds me of the song that, that he performed and recorded live. It's a combination of Stay...
And
when not the music's over, but it's the story of
the
when
rodeo song?
When the concert's over, and everybody's packing up, and he just decides to sit down.
It's the rodeo song.
It's called the rodeo song. And he's singing the song to the band and the roadies, because they've all come to the end of this gigantic tour. And it's his way to say thank you to them and to the people who came to see him. And I was just reminded about that when you said that there are musicians who actually do appreciate, as I observed with the Eagle concerts, where they came out and said, one of the most pleasurable things that we've had is having the opportunity to do this for 52 years, and every single time we've always been received wonderfully well, and they recognize that. Then you have the asshole musicians who think that they're so great, who the audience owes it to them to, I've honored you with my presence. So therefore, you should appreciate the fact that I've been willing to play for you.
And we talked about it earlier, Vince Gill.
Oh, he was just...
With just a guitar, he holds an audience like that with just talent. And it's an attitude, he plays a good guitar.
Yeah, that was an attitude,
But it's an attitude that the audience picks up on. Like you say, at the end of the day, they thank everybody, they're gracious, we're glad you're here. I remember Fleetwood Mac was the same way when we saw him when they signed off. It's like, just be good to each other,
I have two stories. One, Jackson Brown... I've seen him play it numerous times, but I did see him do Stay,
Roadie
song at the end of the concert, and the roadies took everything off the stage other than his piano. They started out with the band, and then, they start turning off the amps, and at the end, it was just him and his piano, and it was like a marvelous sort of story at the same time, that was cool. The other thing about gracious... musicians, David Bowie, when he started out, was like every show was a huge production, and you never got to really see David Bowie. I was
I was blessed enough to see him, you know, 3-4 times at the end of his career. And he'd come out in his Dockers and his loafers, and then I, you know, and he'd talk to the audience, and it was like there was no show. It was just, I'm just going to walk out here and talk to you. And it was amazing to see both sides of that, you know, career. And it didn't stop him from just, like, tearing up the place with songs.
Right.
But in between, he was just chatting and being a nice guy. And it was really different to see that come out of a performer who's been around for 60 years, you know.
Celebrated performer, right, where people would, you know, go significantly out of the way to go see them.
Oh yeah.
To be gracious on the other side, yep, of that, is, I think, is really.
I won't
great.
Talk about Patti Smith on here.
Thank God. Okay. Thank God.
Twice.
Okay, so I think on that second name drop of Patti Smith Bradley, I do think we should wrap this, but we'll wrap this with one more thought. Patti Smith.
Oh, that's three. Okay, we're out of here. So.
Thank you. Good night.
Thank you.
Good night.